Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hills, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour live from Kyiv. Here's what's coming up. Russia steps up its attack on the east as a desperate humanitarian situation grows even more dire. I speak to the UN's relief chief, Martin Griffiths, just back from Moscow. And echoes of Sarajevo 30 years later, Bosnia-born Dunja Mijatović joins me. She's the Human Rights Commissioner for the Council of Europe. And then, maternity wards, hospitals all taking fire. Dr. Hans Kluge, the WHO's Europe's director, sounds the alarm on this medical catastrophe. Plus, writer Jason Stanley talks to Hari Srinivasan about fascism and the dangerous spread of autocracy. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in Kyiv. Weapons, weapons, and weapons. That was the Ukrainian foreign minister's stated goal ahead of today's meetings with his NATO counterparts in Brussels. As Russia regroups and puts its firepower to the south and the east, military experts say that now is the window of opportunity to give Ukraine the wherewithal to defend itself for the rest of this fight. Ukraine's military commander says Russian forces are trying to wipe the southern city of Mariupol off the face of the earth. And our Ben Wiedemann was in Mykolaiv, where he saw the devastating impact of constant bombardment. Here's his report.
This has become Mykolaiv's daily routine, picking up the pieces, sweeping away the wreckage from Russian missile attacks. Random shelling throughout the city, with what appear to be cluster munitions. Glass shards and shrapnel tore into Marina. As she lies in a hospital, her thoughts are with her teenage daughter, also injured, now at a children's hospital. My daughter and I were caught between two bombs, she recalls. It's a miracle we're still alive. It was terrifying. The hospital where Marina is recovering was hit in the morning. Dirt covers the blood from one of the injured. Closed-circuit television video from the city's cancer hospital captures the moment it was struck. Earlier this week, a missile barrage killed 9 people and wounded more than 40 at this market.
We were able to count 23 impact points in a radius of just 100 meters, and each one of these incoming rounds sprays shrapnel in every direction.
Danilo was working in this store and rushed outside when he heard the blasts. Over there, a woman was screaming, "Help me!" Her leg was shattered, he says. Behind the store, 2 people were killed. Dried blood and flowers marked the spot where people died. Last week, a bomb struck the regional governor's office, killing 36 people. Every day in Mykolaiv, this relentless bombardment shatters any semblance of normal life. Mid-afternoon and people line up to escape the danger. This bus bound for Poland. Victoria cradles her 1-year-old daughter, Ivanna. Her husband stays behind. Soon we'll be back home, says Victoria. Everything will be all right. How soon that will be, nobody knows.
And joining me now is Martin Griffiths. He's the UN's relief chief, just back from Moscow. Of course, bearing the brunt of all of this, as we've seen, are the civilians. I mean, that is just the case. Tell me, I mean, your reaction to a report that we've just seen and heard from Mykolaiv, your reaction to what the mayor of Mariupol has been saying, and you can hear in the background the air raid sirens, even here over Kyiv, where the Russians have pulled back. But we were always warned that they would continue to try to harass, even as they shift their real agenda to the east. So let's carry on.
Well, I think what is really the humanitarian priority right now, Christian, is getting people out of those places of danger in the southeast. Mariupol, obviously, but also the Donbass. And getting them out safely seems to be an almost impossible task. We spent 2 weeks, ICRC in the lead, trying to get safe passages for those corridors. I discussed this in Moscow on Monday. I discussed this here today with the Prime Minister and his leadership. I'm convinced that we can do this better, and we need to.
Well, it's an emergency. So when you say you discussed it in Moscow and here, are you saying both sides are preventing this? Well, what's the deal? Why is it being prevented?
Look, I think both sides point the finger of blame at the other. Perhaps that's not surprising. I mean, I and you probably have views as to which of them is correct. But what is essential to
But you're not going to say that because
no,
of being
I'm
at
not,
the UN.
Because I'm,
okay.
I'm trying to make it work.
Right.
And what I think is crucial to make it work is for both sides to actually speak to each other, let's say in front of me or in front of the ICRC, this is what we have committed for tomorrow. Or, even better, for Mariupol, we will have a three-day ceasefire. Nothing will happen in that 3 days. People can come out.
Because I think people don't fully understand that you can't just have a one-hour or two-hour ceasefire. And that's kind of what's been mooted over these last few weeks, that, oh, let's just stop shelling for a couple of hours and get people out. But it doesn't actually work like that, does it?
It doesn't work, and we have so much experience around the world that doesn't work. People need time to get ready to leave. They have to decide to leave. That's not easy. They need to know exactly where they're going. They need to have... we need to have clarity about who to call when it doesn't work. It's clear
like the hotline for
like
the logistics.
The hotline, exactly, that we discussed before. What's clear to us is that if you really want Mariupol and now the Donetsk and Luhansk to work, you've got to go beyond the one day, the next, 10 a.m. the next month. That doesn't work. You need to be clear. Both sides need to be clear. From now until Thursday, nothing will get in the way and we will allow people out.
So can I ask you, because we have less clarity from Moscow than we do from here, because we're here, we can ask the government officials. There, we really can't because of all the regulations that have been put in place against the press. So when you have had your discussions, is it with the foreign minister and whoever it's with, do you get the sense that they actually intend to let you do this? Or is their war effort, in fact, designed precisely for this reason, to basically maybe starve people out, bust their morale, sap their will? What sense do you get?
Well, look, when I was in Moscow, I met the foreign minister and his deputy. I met the deputy defense minister and many of his senior officials. We had a lot of conversations on exactly these issues that you're describing. Look, there is a common interest and a humanitarian interest in enabling and allowing the people of Mariupol to escape. There is a common interest to getting the civilians...
Common between who and
between
who?
The Russians and the Ukrainians.
And you're convinced of that?
I'm convinced that there is one. I'm not convinced that we've seen it reflected in practice.
Right.
And that goes back to my earlier answer to you. Now, you ask a fundamental question as to whether the two sides are serious, and in this case the Russian side is serious about engaging with us. I think they are serious, but in every single conflict that I've been involved in, there's always a deficit of trust, not just in the other side, which is, understandable, but also in the third party, in this case us. However, they both, I think, understand that if they want to make a deal for what my Secretary General has asked me to pursue, which is humanitarian ceasefires, frankly, the UN is still the best vehicle to do that.
Well, I was going to say that. You are the best vehicle, and Russia is part of the Security Council. I mean, clearly, or presumably, of all the institutions, they should trust the UN.
And I was very well received. I know them well. They know us. We had very constructive conversations. We didn't have a breakthrough. And the reason why we didn't have a breakthrough, I believe, is not because of a Russian undervaluing of the UN. After all, they are a key part of it. But because this war is at a certain moment in which it's difficult to achieve this. Two things I would add to that.
Because there's a war aim that they think they can still achieve.
There's a war aim on both sides, and there's certainly a war aim from Russia.
By the way, yes, go ahead.
Two things I would add to that. One is, okay, maybe we can't get a national humanitarian ceasefire. Of course we can't. But maybe we can get local ceasefires, and that will be a huge signal about the willingness of both sides to do the right thing. And the other thing is, if we get lucky with those peace talks hosted in Turkey, God bless Turkey for doing that, maybe we will get a better chance for those ceasefires.
Well, I'm interested to know about that, because just now we've had a dispatch from Moscow where Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister who you met, has basically thrown cold water all over those talks, saying that the Ukrainians, in his view, have shifted their goalposts. In any event, that's not what we're here to talk about. What I want to know is, do they know what's happening in this country, the Russians, and particularly those in power? Because we've heard all these intel reports that apparently Putin and his people are being, misinformed. They claim that there's no shelling or besieging of civilian targets. What do you actually tell them? Do you set them straight?
Look, because I was very straightforward, and there's no reason why not. And as a humanitarian, you can be straightforward. You may not judge, but you can communicate. Yeah.
So you tell them what's happening?
Of course you do.
Do they sound surprised?
They have a point of view. You know, they have a point of view. What was striking to me on this issue, I went today to Bucha. Mm-hmm. And to Irpin. Mm. And
These are the terrible, terrible results now that we've seen since the Russians have pulled back, and we've seen just the wanton death on the streets, literally lying out.
Now, anybody who was guilty of that happening are people who we don't understand. I have said publicly, my Secretary General said, we need to have accountability for that. We need to know who did it. I saw, as you have, the mass graves. You know what's so appalling about those mass graves, Christiane, is that if you are a relative of any of those 280 people dead, the bodies of which have been moved to a mass grave by the local people to get them off the street, and now those bodies are subject to forensic examination, of course, for the rightly, and the relatives still wait for a safe and respectful burial, God help us, that is not the world we want to live in. And of course, it's incumbent on people like me and you to make sure that anybody, whether in Moscow or anywhere else, understands that.
They completely deny that they're responsible. But I mean completely, and despite the fact that there's satellite imagery, there's video imagery, there's drone imagery, there's security camera imagery from whatever, stores and things that were in the region. Deny, deny, deny. It's fake news. Did you tell them about that?
No, because I'd like to know what the actual result is. And I'd like to know that from an investigation, an independent investigation that the Secretary General has called for. The local authorities are now also making their investigation. The sooner we have that result, the better we will be able to present that untested and directly accountable conclusion.
Back to Mariupol, which honestly, I mean, it is just so awful to look at and to hear whatever testimony we can manage to get out of there. There's some 130,000 people still left. How long do you think they can hold out? The mayor called it the new Auschwitz. They're calling it on the brink of a humanitarian catastrophe. Frankly, I thought they'd gone over that brink already.
I think it's a really good question. I asked actually the government here that question because the answer to that question is important for those involved in trying to get safe passage out. Because if we have a week, it's different from if we have 3 days. Mm-hmm. And if we have 2 weeks, even more so. And I don't know what the answer is. And I think that nobody knows the answer to that. Therefore, it's simply urgent. And therefore, any improvements that we can think of, and I promised the Ukrainian Prime Minister today that we would suggest to the methods for evacuation, need to be communicated tomorrow and need to be communicated to the Russian side also tomorrow, because we need action this day, not this week.
Martin Griffiths, you are a very senior UN official. You heard the president of Ukraine, I mean, lay into the UN Security Council the other day. He just said it shouldn't. What is the point if you can't even guarantee or even get a consensus on things like humanitarian and security, obviously? And we've also noticed that the United Nations has not taken the initiative to convene a peace conference or something. Why not? And how do you react to the, some would say, very justifiable criticism of the UN Security Council at this point?
Well, look, I'm fully aware of that criticism. I hear it in my own family. I hear it elsewhere. Secretary General was extremely clear and strong in his statements about the breach of the Charter when this war started. Nobody can suggest to him that he did not take his responsibilities, not as somebody with an opinion about the Charter, but as somebody who pronounces on the Charter. He did that. Secondly, he deliberately decided to send me off to do this assignment. Why? Because he believes, as I do, of course, that in this respect, at least, the UN does have primacy. Humanitarian action is something we do well.
So let's just go back to Bosnia for a second, because we're going to turn to Bosnia. In Bosnia, you did that. Why can't you do it here?
We are trying to do it here. We are trying to use humanitarian access as a building block to end...
What does it take, though? What's the logistics? What it takes is
actually quite simple. It takes a certain amount of confidence of both sides to make those deals to get Mariupol out. It takes professionalism to make those corridors happen, to escort them out. And then it takes a certain amount of creative diplomacy to use that as a platform for confidence to actually resolve the conflict.
So finally, do you think you're in that phase? Do you think you're building that trust and confidence?
I do think so. But as I said to the Security Council yesterday, it's a long haul. It's going to be a long road that we have to travel. You know this. You're here in Kyiv. It's not going to happen tomorrow. But I know, I'm somebody who's tried to pursue ceasefires in different parts of the world. It takes time. It doesn't happen on the first round. And when I was in Moscow, it was the Russians who said to me, look, this is the first round. You got to come back. You got to go to Kyiv. I'm going to hope to go to Turkey. Let's work this. And let's make incremental improvements for the welfare of people. That's the great virtue of humanitarian action. You can help on the edges, which helps individual families. But let's make that help a centerpiece, I hope, of moving out of this war.
Let's hope. Let's hope. Russia is a member of the Security Council. It has a big onus on itself.
We all do.
Martin Griffiths, thank you so much indeed for joining us.
Thanks very much indeed. Thank you.
Now, another effort to isolate Russia on the world stage, the UN General Assembly voted to suspend Russia from its Human Rights Council. This after the world saw the horrific scenes in Bucha that Martin Griffiths has just talked about. He saw them as well. Covering this conflict here in Ukraine, I'm also seeing some painful comparisons to what we all witnessed covering the Bosnian War. This week is the 30th anniversary since the siege of Sarajevo began. That was the longest blockade of any city in modern warfare. Almost 4 years, more than 11,000 people were killed in the capital alone. The Human Rights Commissioner for the Council of Europe is Dunja Mijatović. She herself was born in Sarajevo, and she joins me now from Rome. Dunja Mijatović, thank you very much for joining me. I don't know whether you were able to catch some of what Martin Griffiths was saying about trying to establish, under the UN auspices, humanitarian corridors and relief for places like, of course, Mariupol. I wonder, 30 years after what you all witnessed at home, how you react to that.
It brings, you know, memories, particularly now when we are marking 30 years since the war started. It seems that history repeats itself in Ukraine. In a way, I do not like to compare, but there are so many similarities. And it also brings many memories and suffering of people at that time. What I would like to see now, us, all of us, really helping Ukraine and Ukrainian people in this very difficult time. Humanitarian green corridors are, of course, crucial, and important. And I worked and I discussed all this, and I called for establishing it at the very beginning of this horrific war. But it seems to me that we are all talking and trying to achieve something that is still far away. And as we speak, people are suffering, people are dying, and it seems with all the mechanisms that we have at our disposal that we are somehow failing. That is why I try to do my best, particularly because of everything that happened to us, and you are a witness to this, you know how it was. But in order to move forward and to do more in order to help Ukrainians in this very difficult situation, I think there is a need to show more political will on all sides, pardon me, in order to see some light and to help people that do want to leave Mariupol now for more than a month, Donetsk and many other places in Ukraine.
Dunja Mijatovic, you heard that the UN, Martin Griffiths, wouldn't and couldn't discuss the politics of it all. But of course, the European Union has been very, very clear, and they have launched all sorts of punitive measures against Russia and against the Putin regime, including the UN Human Rights Council has actually managed to isolate Russia a little bit further internationally by having it suspend itself from, or suspending it from, that council. What is your reaction to that, and how do you think that will be effective?
Well, I do hope it will be effective. There is a need, and I think these were strong, strong political signals. I can talk about myself and my engagement with Russian Federation. I think we all in international organizations, we reached the limit. We tried everything. And these measures, excluding or suspending a member state from different international organizations, of course, is not something we'd like to see. But if you have a member state starting the war, bombing the cities, then, of course, you know, there are measures that need to be taken in order to really raise the alarm and to say, stop the war, stop the killing. I was on my way to Zugdidi, to Abkhazia. I was in Georgia when a colleague of mine told me in a car, they're bombing Kiev. And of course, you know, brought the memories of Sarajevo being bombed and all these horrifying scenes that we saw in Bucha and other places. And it is, you know, extremely difficult to understand the reasoning behind it. What can be more important than human life? No politics, no issues related to all these excuses that we heard in the last month and a half on why this war has started. I mean, this is not going to bring any happiness to people or to societies as a whole. So I think this is the moment that there are also certain changes in order to see international organizations being more capable of achieving peace and helping countries that are in a similar situation as Ukraine. Of course, my mandate is very limited. I'm Human Rights Commissioner. I work with human rights defenders, with journalists. I make sure that journalists can be safe, and there are already cases of journalists being killed in Ukraine and also attacked, including CNN crew. So this is also something that I can engage with. But none of this is going to be fruitful, and we will not see the real results if the shooting and bombing does not stop. And this is also, for me, an opportunity to call for it. Because, you know, people I met in Moldova, in Poland, in Hungary, in Slovak Republic, in Czech Republic, all these countries bordering Ukraine that I visited and I spoke to them, they all want to go back home. And I can understand this, but they cannot go back home because of shooting and bombing, and people are becoming even more traumatized, and they will have to deal with these scars like we had to deal with, and we are still dealing with the scars from the Bosnian war.
So let me ask you then, because you know, you you are still dealing with it. And not only that, still dealing, even despite the peace process of Dayton, which really just froze the conflict lines, there's now a renewed threat from Serbia and the Bosnian Serb Republic to try to secede, essentially. I mean, that's the bottom line, with support from Vladimir Putin. What do you think needs to be done to prevent that, to ward that off, so that we don't see in Bosnia again, 30 years later, what we're seeing then and now here in Ukraine?
I think international community is already doing a lot, but not enough. I think it's a bit too late. For many years, I think Bosnia and Herzegovina was abandoned by the international community. And this in this period, there were all those forces that actually started the war. They were returning and again working on the division, injecting hatred among people, talking again about different nationalities and ethnicities. And this is something that is still happening. The story you hear now in Bosnia and Herzegovina is more related to who is Bosniak, who is Serb, and who is Croat. Luckily, we had a very extraordinary marking of the 30th anniversary with all the photographers, journalists from all around the world, joining and really talking about the importance of Bosnia and Herzegovina being multicultural, multi-ethnic society. But then again, if this is not understood in real terms and the threat to Europe and beyond, if it starts again in Bosnia and Herzegovina, then we are going to face even bigger problems in Europe. So now my sort of focus is really to work in Ukraine, but at the same time, also in the Western Balkans, because it's not only about Bosnia and Herzegovina, it's much more than that. It's Croatia, it's Serbia, and it's Montenegro.
Right. Well, Dunja Mijatović, thank you so much indeed for joining us on this pretty auspicious date. Now, with hospitals and medical facilities destroyed in many Ukrainian towns and cities, the healthcare system is in crisis here, forcing thousands of people to forgo help despite catastrophic needs. Today is World Health Day, and the World Health Organization's Europe director is in Lviv in the west of the country. Dr. Hans Kluge, welcome to the program. Let me just start by asking you, I assume it's deliberate that you decided to mark World Health Day today in Ukraine. What's your message today?
It's an act of solidarity, I would say, to the Minister of Health, Dr. Viktor Lashko, to the healthcare workers. They were proudly telling that no any healthcare workers has left the country. They want to stand with their people, protect their health, and that despite of the fact that a very tragic threshold have been passed today of more than 100 healthcare facilities being attacked according to the WHO verification. So I thought that my place as the WHO elected official for the region is really with the Ukraine people today.
And dozens of, you mentioned, 100 healthcare sites and centers have been targeted, and we've been seeing our reporters, us, everyone reporting on that regularly. And also dozens of healthcare workers have been killed. On a practical level, what is the ability of this country today to meet the healthcare needs of all the people who are being wounded and all of those who actually had pre-existing conditions and need ordinary, persistent healthcare?
Well, it's definitely a tremendous burden, humanitarian catastrophe. But to start with the positive, I went to visit health facilities, talk to the doctors, to the nurses, to the patients, and there is a tremendous resilience. I mean, the health workforce, not only in Ukraine, but in the European region, is tired after two terrible pandemic years. And now there is the war. And it's a complex picture because there is, of course, the mental health. People have been seeing really atrocities. Families are being torn apart. There is the communicable disease burden, but also good news. Together with the United States PEPFAR program, since yesterday, we assured for 12 months complete treatment for the 120,000 people on antiretroviral treatment for HIV. And then there's also the chronic disease burden, like cardiovascular diseases, And the minister was telling it's very difficult to plan, because if a certain pharmacy is being bombed tomorrow, it means you have to shift your response. So agility is a very important aspect of the response.
And what do you know about the health situation? I mean, it's almost bizarre to talk about that because it's a catastrophe in Mariupol. But the actual situation, you know, in your field in Mariupol.
Well, it's a very difficult situation, of course. I mean, there is a it's in Mariupol. It's also in places in Luhansk where the facilities are being destroyed. So the top priority, I always say that the most important life-saving medicine that Ukraine need today is peace. We need a humanitarian corridor and the life-saving supplies really to Mariupol. That's the number one priority to help the people.
We were just showing a picture while you were talking, and we remember that early in this conflict, a hospital, a maternity hospital, among many others, was bombed, we believe, either from the air or heavy artillery, long range. And you know, pregnant women, children were also, babies were also killed. The Russians deny it. They say it's fake news. Have you spoken to Moscow, like Martin Griffiths of the UN Relief Organization has been to Moscow? Has your organization, the WHO, appealed to Moscow, talked about the, you know, sanctity of actual healthcare facilities and to lay off this kind of targeting?
Well, first and foremost, we are, of course, horrified as well as the pictures coming out. And both Dr. Tedros, the WHO Director General, and myself have always been very vocal that attacks on health, as we call it, is a breach of international humanitarian law. And this has, what I was hearing from the people here today, as one of the consequences, that hospitals are no longer seen as a safe place, which, of course, is a terrible thing in itself. No, we are talking to all parties through the lens of health for all, that all vulnerable people need to have health care, and that those attacks really need to stop. And of course, yes, as I think there is not a surprise that when you are talking to different parties, there is often a different vision and a different reality of the situation. We are mandated to verify attacks. We don't have the capacities nor the mandate to attribute, because for this there are other bodies like the Security Council, like the International Criminal Court. But if and when we will be asked as a World Health Organization to contribute as part of the UN family, we definitely will do so within our mandate.
And of course, we heard from Martin Griffiths and others that despite being part of the UN Security Council, Russia continues to do this kind of thing. That's what we are observing. And of course, it says that it is not part of the International Criminal Court, therefore nothing to do with that. So on that issue, you have heard the United States, some Ukrainian officials, NATO officials warning that potentially they are concerned that President Putin might allow or might order the use of chemical weapons. Is that something that you as the WHO are taking into consideration and trying to prepare people here for in a medical way? Is that something that you're doing?
Well, I always say we hope for the best, but we have to prepare for the worst. And if you look at the situation, I mean, one figure, 80,000 babies are going to be born in Ukraine in the next 3 months with a peri and postnatal care, which is very suboptimal. You have measles, you have the polio. So yes, we are working closely with the national and local authorities to prepare for any eventualities, be it including chemical attacks or radiological, not necessarily from an attack, but other threats, but in partnership with other organizations, like, for example, the International Atomic Agency in Vienna. We're issuing norms, guidance, and together with the Ministry of Health, doing a lot of capacity strengthening, yes.
It's a very grim prospect. Can I ask you, because I think your organization has said and has sort of overseen a pretty robust effort before this war to reform the Ukrainian health system as a whole. all the health services so that it better meets the need of the people here. Can you explain that? How extensive was that effort? What was the success? And what's the setback now, given this war?
Absolutely. Since many decades, WHO had a big footprint here. And to give one example, Ukraine was one of the best practices in the region on tuberculosis control, introducing new innovative technologies to be able to rapidly detect TB infection. But we worked very, very closely together on primary healthcare to bring care out of the institutions closer to the homes of the people on health financing. And that's another indeed very big collateral, that those hard-won gains have no setback. At the same time, again, I have a lot of admiration to the Minister of Health, Dr. Viktor Lashko, and his people when we discussed the determination today already to work with the World Health Organization on building back better for the future. And when we shook hands at the end, there was this kind of, let's say, light of optimism that it's a terrible situation, but looking forward, let's build back better.
Dr. Hans Kluge, WHO's Europe Director, thank you so much for joining us from Lviv, Ukraine, tonight. Now, manifestations of fascist ideology infiltrate democratic nations, and illiberal democracies have gained a solid foothold in some parts of Europe. Jason Stanley is the author of How Fascism Works, and he examines Putin's brand of that ideology in his latest piece for Tablet magazine. He joins Hari Srinivasan to explore this version of fascism and how it targets the West's vulnerabilities.
Christian, thanks. Jason Stanley, welcome back to this program. You have written an authoritative book on fascism. I want to look a little bit at the type of fascism that maybe is playing out in front of our eyes in the case of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and how that's different from the definitions that we might have seen in our textbooks.
So Russian fascism, and I think it's just an almost unmistakable species of fascism. It is a classic kind of fascism in its colonial aspect. So fascism is typically linked to empire, the desire to restore empire. We find fascist leaders gaining popularity when they can talk about lost empire and tell their citizens that that they're going to be the leader who's going to violently restore their empire and their place in the world. So in that sense, it's a classic kind of fascism. And it's, and in its violence and militarism, it's a classic kind of fascism. And in the way that it appeals to anti-LGBT sentiment in a number of other ways, it's classic fascism. But Russia seeks to, as it were, because it cannot dominate the world militarily anymore or economically. It's really not a superpower like China or the United States. It's really seeking to dominate the world ideologically. And what does that mean here? What it means is Putin seeks to be the leader of the world's traditionalists, the ethno-nationalists, the patriarchal, anti-democratic, in the United States, white supremacists. He seeks to say, I am going to defend traditional values against decadence and weakness. And so in this way, he's going to gather all the different ethno-nationalist movements to him. And also, he's going to gather traditionalist members of minority groups who might not be led to follow a kind of strict ethnic nationalism.
One of the rationales that Vladimir Putin explicitly gave anyway, was that he wanted to denazify Ukraine and almost indemnify himself from this idea that he was perpetrating an aggressive act.
This is classic fascism. Classic fascism involves calling what your enemy, calling your enemy what you yourself are, what you yourself are. So so Putin is clearly doing this in Ukraine. By denazification, Putin means that he's going to go into Ukraine, he's going to take the democratic ideology that Ukraine has embraced since the Maidan Revolution of 2014. He's going to remove it from institutions and schools and politics. He's going to place the leaders on trial and show trials, reminiscent of Nuremberg, execute or imprison them, and replace them with Russian Russian fascist ideologues, and extinguish completely Ukrainian democratic identity and Ukrainian identity, full stop.
So what can the democracies that are standing around the planet do in the face of this? In the absence of a military intervention, we obviously have put in economic sanctions that are slower working than many people would like. But how does ideologically democracy stand up in the face of this?
So recall from the beginning of our discussion that Putin's version of fascism is not specifically about Russian ethnic Russians dominating the world, as German fascism was. German fascism was about Aryans dominating the world. It's about traditionalist ethno-nationalists dominating each of their countries with a strong, powerful, masculine leader. So it could be a woman, I suppose, as we see in France's elections, but it's about a kind of, it's about protecting supposedly traditional values against democracy, decadence, etc. So what democracies must do is that they must show that they're not corrupt, decadent, and weak. That's what Putin believes. That's what Putin fosters. And I don't want to say Putin is the singular agent here. The United States has long had anti-democratic forces of this sort that Putin allies with. But democracies have to show that they are strong. And democracies can show they are strong. Ukraine is showing that it is strong. I remember my grandmother in her book, The Unforgotten, a 1958 book, talks about how she's with my father in New York City. They've just come from Hitler's Germany. And my father is looking at these soldiers marching down Broadway. It's 1941, chewing gum and slapping each other's backs. And my father says they're never going to beat the Nazis, because he had seen the Nazi army march down the Kufersendamm in Berlin in strict order. And my grandmother said, no, that's exactly why they will beat the Nazis. And that's what Ukraine is showing right now. Ukraine is showing that democracies have strength and democracies have value. Democracies have strength when they stand up for their values, when they prove accountability. And what Putin thinks, rightfully so, is that democracies have proven themselves to be hypocritical and weak. Look, our democracies have always been partial. So the best thing we can do is we can show that our democracies stand up for the values that they represent, freedom and equality.
Do you think that the events in the past few years in the United States has weakened the brand of democracy that we've been exporting around the world? And does Putin pick up on that and say, look at this, you can meddle with an election, you can cause internal strife, but then you can even have people attack its own capital and frankly, not be held accountable.
That's exactly right. I don't like the language of exporting because, frankly, when we've tried to export democracy, it's typically been at the barrel of a gun, and that is not how you export a democracy. You export democracy by standing up for its values at home, and we failed to do that. We failed in accountability for our own imperial wars of aggression, like the Iraq War. We failed with accountability for the financial crisis, and we failed most recently with accountability for the attack on our own democracy. So obviously, Putin is right to think that democracies are weak and don't stand up for their values. If we can't hold accountable the figures who led us into wars that cause terrible devastations, if we can't hold accountable business leaders who destroyed our economy, and if we can't hold accountable a president who tried to steal the election and destroy American democracy, together with the numerous senators and congressmen who helped him, then in what sense are we a democracy? We don't have the rule of law. And so in what sense do we have free and fair elections? The threat to autocracies is free and fair elections. Putin can look at the United States and he can direct the world's gaze to the United States and show and say, see, look at what they're doing. They have non-existent a voter fraud, yet they're fighting it with a electoral police, with numerous legislation essentially to restrict voting and to potentially steal another election. So democracies do seem openly hypocritical and weak. And that is obviously, that is what Russia wants. Russia's not going to dominate the world. Russia is not a world power. But Russia can help destroy democracy worldwide and thereby preserve its own autocratic regime at home.
One of the chapters in your book deals with a sexual anxiety that is often used in fascism. And I wonder what you think when you look at the number of laws that are now making their way through state legislatures, either restricting women's control of their bodies or LGBTQIA rights in the United States.
Right. So we should always remember, we citizens of a democracy, that the principal values of democracy are freedom and equality. And among the freedoms that citizens of a democracy enjoy are the freedoms the freedoms to identify how they want, to have the partners, to have the adult partners they want. And this freedom is under attack. Now, this kind of attack on LGBT citizens is very Eastern European in character. It comes in the wake of an attack on so-called critical race theory, but the attack is really not on critical race theory. It's an attack on the teaching of our history, the teaching of our anti-democratic racist history. And now we have an attack on LGBT rights. This puts us into the worldwide autocratic context. If you look at autocrats and would-be autocrats all over the world, from Russia's gay propaganda law in 2013 that prohibits teaching minors about non-standard lifestyles, of non-traditional lifestyles. That was passed in 2013 and had a terrible effect on the LGBT community in Russia. If we look at Viktor Orban's Hungary, the recent election was dominated by attacks on LGBT. We look at Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, and he won election with attacks on LGBT. We see the American right now embracing this worldwide far-right autocratic attack on freedom. Putting us in line with the rest of the fascist right worldwide.
What is it about this that you think historically has stuck and even today makes it something that people can campaign on?
In the United States, the base for this far-right politics includes white nationalists. But if you want to include some people who aren't white, go after a small minority like transgender Americans, a tiny group of Americans. Then you can gather a lot of people because, you know, everyone is like, I'm not that. And so maybe I can join the group and vilify them. So this group of traditionalists can then gather. And then even though this, you know, in the United States, the audience here includes white nationalists who very prominently want to return to sort of a state that prioritizes white Christianity, they can have plausible deniability because they can say, look, We've got Black members of our movement who mm-hmm. also share with us this antipathy to LGBT. So it's about gathering a larger coalition by ever greater vilification of a small minority, while winking to the part of the coalition, the large part of the coalition, that this is really helping. In the case of the United States, that would be sort of white Christianity.
There was a piece in the New York Times recently, I think it's Elizabeth Diaz and Ruth Graham, talking about how the growing religious fervor in the far right movement is starting to include religious iconography. It is including praise music. It's almost a little bit of a revival. Now, not everybody under the tent, so to speak, is coming for a church service, but it's certainly pulling in people who are devout.
So that's because the global far-right fascist movement presents itself as the defender of traditional values. And this is not new. This is textbook fascist politics. If you look at Joseph Goebbels' speech, Communism with the Mask Off, in 1935, Goebbels says that Jewish Bolshevism is threatening religious faith, Christianity, and that the only protection is National Socialism. So what Putin is doing is he's reviving these themes. He's saying liberalism is a threat to tradition. Of course, liberalism is not a threat to tradition. Liberalism says that my Orthodox Jewish cousins can live however they want, and other people who aren't religious can also live however they want. But the idea here is to create this fear among people who choose to live traditionally, that other people's choices threaten them, and in particular, threaten their children. And then you say to them, look, they're going after your children. You need us to protect you. And then you say, look, you know, we can't play fair anymore. What democracy is, and this goes back really to some of the oldest and worst tropes of the 20th century, like the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. What democracy is it's this method for pretend equality. It says everyone can live what they want, how they want. But then really what it does is these liberties allow them to get at your children and corrupt your children. And so you create such fear among traditionalists that they abandon democracy.
As an example of that, Marjorie Taylor Greene tweeted the other day, Democrats, I'm quoting, are the party of killing babies, grooming and transitioning children, and pro-pedophile politics. In a recent poll, 49% of Republicans said it was, quote, definitely or probably true that top Democrats were involved in elite child sex trafficking rings. QAnon conspiracies, these are going viral, and I'm wondering, this is not a small population of people in the United States that believe these things.
Let's be very clear. QAnon, as all scholars who've written on it have said, Talia Lavin, David Livingstone Smith, is clearly descended from blood libel, the conspiracy theory against Jews that Jews were stealing Christian babies for their religious rituals, and the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. It's this conspiracy that there's a global cabal of elites, and the global cabal of elites is seeking to conquer the institutions to get at your children and control your children. And so there's no fairness anymore. It's just war. And you're not a man if you can't stand up to this because they're going after your women and children. It's that level of fear and paranoia that is seeped into, I don't even think seeped into is the right word anymore, that has permeated much of American politics. And so it's a very extreme time when these sorts of old conspiracy theories have infected the body politic.
Jason Stanley, professor of philosophy at Yale, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Stark warnings indeed. And finally tonight, on the road with one of the most dangerous concert tours in history, Ukraine's biggest rock star, Svatoslav Vakarchuk, has been traveling across the country, aiding the war effort by performing and boosting morale amid this Russian invasion. Through it all, he has seen the fierce resilience of the Ukrainian people that continues to burn brightly. And just today, he was among ruins in the city of Chernihiv, since the Russian forces have pulled back a few days ago now.
In the worst situation you can imagine, you've lost your relatives, someone who you loved, you've lost your home, everything, and you still have this optimism and readiness to go further and optimism for the future. That's why I think Ukrainians are undefeatable.
And we want to leave you now with some of his music. Thank you for watching and goodbye from Kyiv. We'll see you again tomorrow night. Як уявляли ми,
світ, два кроки від весни, два кроки від зими. Та більше не лякають нас.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.